This is the closing plenary session of the fourth week of the winter program. In response to the chapter in Jim Wallace's book entitled The Injustice, in 1980, the United States government, under the direction of President Jimmy Carter, under the auspices of the Council on Environmental Quality and the Department of State, issued the Global 2000 report to the President, which is well summarized in its first two paragraphs, which some of you have heard before, but they're worth a minute to repeat again. If present trends continue, the world in 2000 will be more crowded, more polluted, less stable ecologically, and more vulnerable to disruption than the world we live in now. Serious stresses involving population, resources, and environment are clearly visible ahead. Despite greater material output, the world's people will be poorer in many ways than they are today. For hundreds of millions of the desperately poor, the outlook for food and other necessities of life will be no better. For many, it will be worse. Barring revolutionary advances in technology, life for most people on Earth will be more precarious in 2000 than it is now, unless the nations of the world act decisively to alter current trends. This message is not new. This message has been brought at least since 1954, when Harrison Brown published The Challenge of Man's Future, which, as far as I was aware, aroused less attention at the time even than the Global 2000 report has. It has most of the same considerations in it. It has the same kinds of conclusions in it, much more thoroughly explained, of course, since there's much more substance to that volume than to just the summary volume. It has no official governmental status, but that probably makes relatively little difference when there's been a presidential election in between the issuance of the Global 2000 report and the present. I mention Harrison Brown's book particularly, rather than Limits to Growth or any of the population explosion of books on the future that has taken place within the last 10 years, chiefly because it explains the choice of the title for his more recent book, The Human Future Revisited. Revisited because he hasn't had too much reason to change his mind since 1954. He is a well-known geologist, geochemist, was at California Institute of Technology at this time. Now he lives in Hawaii. He's director of the Resource Systems Institute at the East-West Center in Honolulu. And he has been a thoughtful observer of the human condition and commenter on it from the perspective particularly of the physical sciences for at least 30 years. As I went through the various materials which I had that related to the question of global injustice from the point of view of resources and distribution, I found that practically everything is in The Human Future Revisited, and I need supplement it only occasionally with other things that I have. And so my organization will be courtesy of Harrison Brown. Striking thing has happened since World War II in that the world has pretty much divided into two groups, not East and West, communist and capitalist, but North and South, rich and poor. With very little in between. Brown calls it no less than a fissioning of human society into two quite separate and distinct cultures, culture of the rich and the culture of the poor. I have written down here several figures in comparing these two. There are, as we see, a few in-betweens, but really relatively few. The bulk of the world's population, whether you look at 1970 or increasingly in 1976, falls under the heading of the poor. The measures of wealth that he uses first are the relative consumption of energy, where each person in the rich minority uses 20 times the energy that is available to each person in the poor majority. And as far as gross national product per person, the rich at 15 times that of the poor back in 1970. Later on in the chapter dealing with the poor, but I'll mention it now since the figures are here and I'm here and you're there. 1976, population grows more rapidly among the poor than among the rich, now 3 times rather than 2.5 times in number. Gross national product per capita has increased for both. It's now up to 1/11 as much for the poor rather than 1/15 as much as previously. Birth rates are twice as high, death rates 1.5 times as high. And of course, when you combine those two, then you find population growth rates on the bottom line 3 times as high among the poor as among the rich. Life expectancy, only 7/10 as great for the poor. Infant mortality, 5 times as great. And the literacy rate, only 40% as high among the poor as in the rich nations, where the literacy rate is nearly everyone. So the question needs to be addressed, I think, of how did we get where we are and why are they where they are? And Brown has some comments on that. He says, it has become increasingly clear that technological change has played an enormous role in the economic and social development of the United States, which can't be explained satisfactorily solely on the basis of capital, labor, and land. The missing ingredient is a combination of interrelated elements which have variously been called innovation, technical change, scientific and engineering advance, research and development, advances of knowledge, education, improved communications, improved techniques of management, and training of labor. Economists disagree as to the relative importance of those elements, but the studies indicate that over the years, that kind of approach to things has been responsible for at least 50% of the annual growth of the United States, and probably more. Which is not to say that capital, labor, and land were lacking, and natural resources of various sorts. One of the most important characteristics of the growth of the American economy has been the spectacular growth of the productivity, production per worker hour, in agriculture and industry, which increased 13-fold between 1900 and 1976 because, of course, of mechanization. High productivity in the agriculture and manufacturing sectors could have meant high levels of unemployment had not a new phenomenon entered the picture, the service economy. The end of World War II, 55% of all workers were in service occupations. By 1974, more than 2/3 of all job holders. In the large cities, even more so, in New York, more than 80% of the total employment is in the service sector, and as more manufacturing firms leave the city, the proportion will increase still further. Key element in the expansion of the services has been the number of public employees. Persons who provide federal, state, county, and city services represent nearly 16% of all employment. Another 6% by nonprofit institutions such as private schools and colleges, foundations, labor unions, and churches. And another 8% by companies such as Lockheed or General Electric, who work on projects where the entire output, whether it be missiles or research, is paid for by the U.S. government. So, turns out that one in every three jobs in the present economy is in the public, not-for-profit sector, and about one out of every four, directly or indirectly, dependent on governmental activities. Thus, the United States is the richest of the rich nations. There's much to be viewed with pride. The condition of our average citizens in their comfortable homes, their high levels of education, their ease of travel, their ready access to news, entertainment. We're rightfully proud of our democratic institutions and political freedoms, our scholarly and artistic achievements. We're proud of a broad spectrum of initiatives which we have taken both individually and collectively. But, and we've talked about some of those things, and Wallace talks very pointedly about some of those things. Grave uneasiness spreading over the land, shared in different ways by the poverty-stricken of the slums of the central city and the wealthy suburbanites with their swimming pools heated with once abundant natural gas. Poverty and affluence, unemployment and inflation, crime, strikes of public workers, ugliness in the cities, noxious fumes in the airs, wanton destruction of natural beauty, the nuclear umbrellas which can destroy us, the oil embargoes, terrorism, illegal immigration. In August of 1977, Time magazine had a cover story on the American underclass. First paragraph reads, "The barricades are seen only fleetingly by most middle-class Americans as they rush by in their cars or commuter trains, doors locked, windows closed, moving fast. But out there is a different world, a place of pockmarked streets, gutted tenements, and broken hopes. Affluent people know little about this world, except when despair makes it erupt explosively onto page one or the 7 o'clock news. Behind its crumbling walls lives a large group of people who are more intractable, more socially alien, and more hostile than almost anyone had imagined. They are the unreachables, the American underclass. People who are seen to be stuck more or less permanently at the bottom, removed from the American dream. Mostly impoverished urban blacks, although members come from all races and live in many places. The universe of the underclass is often a junk heap of rotting housing, broken furniture, crummy food, alcohol, and drugs. The underclass has been doubly left behind by the well-to-do majority and by the many blacks and Hispanics who have struggled up to the middle class or who remain poor but can see a better day for themselves or their children. Its members are victims and victimizers in the culture of the street hustle, the quick fix, the rip-off, and not least, violent crime." So, in one sense, perhaps one of the main differences between the United States and the world is that in the United States, the rich are the majority, in the world, the rich are the minority. Well, what about the rest of the world? The concluding statement in the several pages about the Soviet Union, Brown says, "The main reason for Soviet power is that by now she has developed her technology to the point where it is bound to continue to develop further so that she can make full use of her natural resources, which are vast. For the foreseeable future, the Soviet Union will be self-sufficient in minerals, food, wood, and above all, energy. Other industrial nations, including the United States, are not likely to be in that position for a very long time, if ever." Japan Japan's success in modernization seems all the more remarkable when we consider the scarcity of available natural resources. Only 15% of Japan's land can be farmed. Mineral resources are scarce. There are numerous swift streams for hydropower, but other than that, only coal for energy resource, and that difficult to mine and of poor quality. Japan had no colonies in the 19th century. The main natural resource consisted of hardworking, intelligent people, bound together by a social fabric which was conducive to innovation, collaboration, and rapid change. Of course, at the end of the Second World War, the Japanese economy was in ruins. She'd lost her recent colonies and substantial foreign investments in Manchuria and China, as well as commercial dominance in Asia. Most of the cities had been devastated, housing, industrial plants, transportation, severe shortages of food and raw material, extremely low morale of the people. But starting from these depths, a second Japanese development miracle took place, which in its way was as surprising as what took place in Europe. By 1970, Japan had become the third greatest industrial power in the world. Her economy grew faster than that of any large country, and not only did she recover, her real national income was by now several times larger than it had been before the war. After 1955, it was as though a chain reaction had been ignited. The transistor revolutionized the electronics industry. Television sets became a major item for export. The Japanese started their passionate love affair with the automobile. Soon the Japanese people themselves had become the most inexhaustible and enthusiastic consumers the world had ever seen. By 1974, per capita consumption of steel and energy was equal to that in Western Europe. In 25 years, starting from the dismal depths of wartime destruction, the Japanese had achieved the highest standard of living that they had ever known. So they fall in the same column as the United States, Canada, Western Europe, the left column on the board. Well, what about the prospects for the rest of the world, the majority of the world? There are some very important differences among nations there also. Brown has a way of calculating a physical quality of life index, which includes life expectancy, infant mortality, and literacy. And the evidence seems to be that in Africa, south of the Sahara, substantial increases in the per capita gross national product don't seem to become reflected to any appreciable extent in the quality of life. One is tempted to conclude that most increased average income in Africa benefits only a small proportion of the population. In Asia, on the other hand, the resources and benefits appear to be more equitably distributed, at least from the point of view of nutrition, health, and elementary education. And the non-OPEC Arab countries and Latin American countries also seem to show that increased gross national product does show up as better quality of life for most of the people. Within the poorer developing countries, there's again a mixture of a poor majority and a rich minority. The latter often tend to live in European fashion, have correspondingly high incomes. If you have a poor majority with an average per capita income of $100 a year, and then you add to that 2% of people with a per capita income of $5,000, then you've doubled the national per capita GNP without improving the lot of 98% of the people one bit. The most single element of individual well-being is food. Hungry and malnourished people cannot function properly. Well-fed people are not necessarily happy, but adequate nutrition is an essential component of a contented, meaningful life. Most, not all, but most of the hunger in the world is in the developing countries. Lack of adequate nutrition is the main contributor to the high rates of infant mortality in these areas, as well as to the generally high death rates, which stem from both epidemic and endemic disease. Malnourished people, particularly children, cannot fight disease effectively. So they don't starve to death, but poor nutrition contributes to their dying of disease. most developing countries, there are enormous inequities in food available. At the World Food Conference in 1974, they pointed out that in many countries, the 20% of the population with the lowest income had only half the per capita calorie intake that the top 10% had. About half the children under 5 years of age in the poor countries may be inadequately nourished, so large numbers of them either die or suffer serious biological damage, which handicaps them in later life. Then he has a table reflecting the share of the national income of various population groups in selected countries, and I'll just read to you a few of those. In Ecuador, 1970, the richest 20% had 73.5% of the national income. The poorest 20% only 2.5%, which meant the rich were 30 times as rich as the poor. Kenya, richest 20%, 68%, poorest 20%, 3.8%, 18 times as much for the rich as the poor. Sri Lanka, richest 20%, 46% of the income. Poorest 20%, 6% of the income. Ratio of 7.7 times. Rather different picture. What would you guess for the United States? Richest 20% would have, what would you think? The extremes I quoted were 73% for Ecuador, 46% for Sri Lanka.
It's a lot. Now you're talking about the amount that corporate heads earn?
The richest 20% of the people, however they got it. Whether they got it by inheriting it, by being presidents of multinational corporations, by being rock singers or baseball players, or whoever the richest 20% are.
They must be 100 times richer.
38.8%. The poorest 20%, 6.7%, ratio 5.8%. Income is a little better distributed here by that criterion than it is in Sri Lanka, which is by far, well, no, Egypt is almost as equitable a distribution as Sri Lanka, but the maldistribution based on that kind of figure is less a problem here than it is in the developing countries. Yes, 52% for the richest 20%, 5 for the poorest 20, or 10 times as much. So it's in between. No, they only have developing countries and the United States for that one comparison.
Do they break it down by poverty as well as income?
No.
So I've seen another table that compared, the property owned by the richest 20%, and that was very comparable to several developing countries.
Right. Goes along with it, I think. It mentions particularly among the poor countries two where serious malnutrition on any substantial scale appears to have been eliminated despite the fact individual incomes are very low. Any idea which two of the poor countries don't have nutrition as their main problems? Specific countries. Well, one of them is Sri Lanka, which had the best income distribution. The other is the People's Republic of China. They don't give the comparable figures here because I'm sure there are no figures available to us that would have any meaning to compare. Besides poverty and population growth, the major cause of hunger involves the instability of food supplies. The most severe famine in South Central Asia in three decades was Bangladesh in 1974. The summer crop was destroyed by floods. The region in Africa immediately south of the Sahara, known as the Sahel, suffered for five consecutive years from severe drought, which led to widespread starvation. Another impact has been the 1973 to 74 increase in oil prices, again in 79-80, particularly among those countries which had benefited from the Green Revolution and therefore had come to rely heavily on imported fertilizers and petroleum and were very hard hit by the rapid rise in those prices, and agricultural production suffered seriously. The poor, of course, lacked any resources to endure prolonged periods of shortage. Governmental policies are very important within those countries. Witness the two that with low income still have relatively adequate nutrition. But in many developing countries, government policies work in the opposite direction, providing disincentives rather than incentives for increased production. In Thailand, for example, there's a large unrealized potential for rice production, but government policy keeps the price the farmers receive for rice far below its real value, and at the same time, the cost of fertilizer to the farmer is maintained above the world price.
Why is that?
Because of the fact that people in cities are politically more visible and more threatening than people in the country. And Egypt also has had very low prices, Poland too. Food prices kept artificially low. When the government raises the prices to come anywhere nearer, closer to what it actually costs to raise that food, then there are riots and the government may back off. The people in the country are so spread out and so far from the political power that they have no recourse. You consider the rates of population growth, even with the fact that there is enough food being produced now that it could feed the world if the people could get it. You need to double food production within the developing countries in about 20 years. Some of it, but not much, could come from increasing the land area. From the purely technological point of view, such large rates of increase in yield appear to be readily attainable. Even if you look at what's been happening, the empirical point of view, the demand does not seem unreasonably high. Some 30 developing countries between 65 and 75 achieved that 3 to 4% annual rate of increase in overall agricultural production that is estimated as necessary for the entire developing world over the next quarter century. But if you look at the social and political questions, the outlook is less optimistic. Major incentives to the farmers, such as land reform and increased prices for their production, are difficult to bring about. Well, we've already indicated why. As Eric points out, most of the land is owned by the wealthy few, who necessarily then, from their own point of view, oppose land reform. Higher prices to the farmer are anathema to the city dwellers, who must then pay higher prices for their food. And further increases in crop yields require a great deal of local agricultural research, and in many countries there simply aren't enough trained people and an organized structure to do that research, even if the money were available. Governments are more likely to invest scarce resources in urban services than in rural irrigation projects or facilities for grain storage. Close to 1 billion people inhabit about 40 poor countries which are in serious trouble with respect to energy, which means fertilizer. Their annual bill for importing fertilizers made from petroleum, for importing crude oil and cereal grains, increased greatly following the price rise in 73-74. This is money they do not have. One result has been increased debt. A more serious result has been the decreased expansion in the use of fertilizers and pumped water, which means decreased improvements in crop yields. The key to eliminating dire poverty and associated with it malnutrition is to increase the agricultural productivity of small farmers and to expand job opportunities in rural areas. Solution to these problems requires comprehensive programs of rural redevelopment, including such elements as land reform, access to credit, and assured availability of water.
Bill?
Yes?
In that access to credit, how does a developing nation that's never been able to pay back their debts get money from, like, can they get loans from the World Bank, or?
Well, we'll
cut their credit off and just
have a few more to say that about that a little later on, where the information is, with some actual figures as to how much has come in from cooperating nations, from private philanthropy, and from commercial investment, which are the three potential sources, as well, of course, as the economic structure of the country itself, where there may be a considerable amount of wealth in the hands of central banks that doesn't get out to the people. It's virtually impossible for a developing country to carry out a viable development program unless it's either quite large and well endowed with natural resources like mainland China, or imports quantities of raw materials and machinery. To pay for the imports, a country must either export commodities and manufactured goods of equivalent value, receive financial assistance from other countries, or go into debt. About 1.2 billion people inhabit 44 countries that are in serious trouble with respect to money, raw materials, particularly energy. They're now referred to as the fourth world. They're the poorest nations on earth. Prospects for future economic growth are dismal. Their annual bill for essential imports is greatly increased because of crude oil prices, money they do not have. They must borrow. Their situation has been exacerbated by a prolonged slowdown in the economies of the industrial nations, which led to reduced economic assistance, reduced direct private investment, and reduced export earnings.
So what is an example of, or a few examples of fourth world nations?
Well, the nations like the majority of those in southern Africa, except Zimbabwe and the Union of South Africa, places like Chad, Ethiopia.
Isn't Chad considered fifth world because it has no natural resources and is landlocked?
Yeah. Well, some people have extended the designation down to them to a fifth world. He only goes as far as fourth here, Bangladesh. I'm not sure which Latin American countries would be included. Certainly Brazil would not. It's because Argentina would not. But, well, Venezuela would not. It's an OPEC member.
It sounds like the trickle-down theory does work a little bit.
Yeah, we'll have more to say about that. This will all be gone into at the proper time. So what does it take for economic and social development to take place? Many things have to happen at the same time. There has to be capital to construct industries and schools, provide city services, develop transportation and communication, which may be among the most important things for the rural areas. Expand variety of rural developments like irrigation, agricultural schools, public health facilities. How can capital be accumulated? Internal savings. If most people live at a subsistence level, they're in no position to be taxed directly or open bank accounts. How else then? Sale of primary commodities. Sale of manufactured products. Private investment from outside the country, private loans, economic assistance from other countries in the forms of loans and gifts. Scarcity of skilled labor in the poorest countries make them unlikely candidates for private foreign investment. Their very poorness mitigates against their receiving private foreign loans with any reasonable terms. That would be investment by multinational corporations, by loans granted by individual commercial banks, and so forth. In 1975, the capital inflow to the poorest nations from public sources, from governments and international agencies, was 5 times greater than from private sources. But the total net flow was very small compared to the need, $7.2 billion, or $6 a person, in loans granted by World Bank, Export-Import Bank, and any other governmental or international agencies. But if you look at those relatively few middle-income developing countries, they are in the market economy, and 2/3 of the capital flow to them, not counting the oil-exporting ones, was from private sources, $28 billion, or $40 per person, corporations, commercial banks. The debt burdens of the developing countries have increased substantially because of the widening gap between imports and exports. 1975, total external debt of the middle-income non-oil exporters, $88 billion, that of the poorest nations, $28 billion. The increased borrowing continued in 1976, spurred by the balance of payment surpluses in the OPEC nations. Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and United Arab Emirates in particular have been unable to spend their oil income rapidly enough. They've deposited enormous sums in major banks in the United States and other industrial countries. To keep this cash moving, the banks have been lending the funds to less developed countries. In the process, the banks have made themselves vulnerable to the possibility of substantial default, as well as pressures from OPEC. By early 1977, the developing countries owed banks in the United States about $50 billion, rose to $77 billion, and the fear was expressed the banks would be forced to keep on making new loans to forestall default on the old ones. They couldn't afford to call in the loans, which couldn't be paid back, would lead to the total collapse of the economies of those countries.
What do they ask as collateral? I mean, what are they going to do to take the country?
That's the point.
What they usually do is when the country asks for more money later, then the World Bank puts demands on how the country is run. So, you know, in one sense of the word, yeah, they do take the country as collateral. They make demands about how the economics of the country will be run in order to get new loans.
Bill, I was just thinking of a developing nation in our own country, which is Franklin, West Virginia. It's the nearest town to our farm. There was no employment there, and unemployment was very, very high. Hanover Shoe Factory came in to see if they would build a factory, and of course the townspeople were delighted. But Franklin had to sell its soul, so to speak, to get the factory. They had to promise to build the building, and not to charge any taxes for the land, and promise that they would not unionize. So here are these people stuck in this horrible condition of shoe factory, and every time I would get really upset about it or write letters to the editor of our newspaper, you get a phone call and say, do you realize what you're doing? At any time, the shoe factory can just pull out and leave us without any kind of employment. I mean, it was real. People were very upset if you criticized Hanover, but it was just manipulating and exploiting those people in West Virginia. I suppose that's repeated in many places in the United States.
Well, besides the difficulty of getting the necessary capital, one of the biggest obstacles to development lies inside the countries, where the privileged elites, even in the very poorest countries, like things the way they are and will go to great lengths to keep them that way. Many import luxuries and thus lessen the resources available for development. Many export money to private bank accounts in the industrial countries. Many will happily accept substantial bribes to influence their governments to accept business contracts. And often live in fear of any truly meaningful political economic change because they might lose both wealth and prestige. Yet another hindrance to development is the expenditure of funds for military purposes. 1974, the developing countries collectively spent about $50 billion on their military establishments, of which some $6 billion went to buy arms from the industrial countries. These figures can be compared, the $50 billion compared to $37 billion for education and $10 billion for public health. Not surprisingly, per capita military expenditures increased with per capita gross national product. 1974, military expenditures of the poorest countries consumed about 4% of the GNP, which seemed necessary to them because of perceived threats to their security, both from within and without, represented twice the amount spent collectively by the same countries on public education. In the same year, however, the combined military expenditures of the industrial countries exceeded the total gross national products of the poorest countries by 17%. Clearly, if military expenditures in the rich and the poor nations were lower, development could proceed at a more rapid pace. For the most part, development policies since World War II were based on the trickle-down principle, which assumed that accelerated economic growth at the top would eventually benefit the entire population, including the poor. However, that hasn't always happened. The experiences of the last three decades have led to a rethinking of approaches to development. A new understanding is now emerging which suggests primary effort should be placed on the improvement of the condition of the absolute poor in the developing countries. It is now recognized, perhaps too late, that given the political will, poverty, hunger, and malnutrition in these areas could be alleviated in a relatively short time. At the end of the process, few people would be rich, but most would have a reasonable chance of achieving happiness. It is clear that expanded transfers of capital from the rich countries to the poor are essential if dire poverty is to be eliminated. But it's doubtful that a doubling the amount of capital flow all at once could be effectively absorbed. There simply are not enough trained persons in the poorer countries who are able to make the decisions which must be made and to solve the problems which must be solved if development is to take place. And of course, they don't want other people coming in and making all those decisions for them. Until recent years, per capita GNPs have increased, even in the poorest countries, and so have their physical quality of life. But the real problem concerns the future. Unless the process of development is accelerated, it is likely some truly explosive situations will emerge to endanger all humanity, including the rich countries. It's doubtful that development will take place fast enough unless the governments of the richer countries transfer to the poorer ones as much capital each year as can truly be absorbed effectively. And he suggests that something like 1% of the GNP from the rich country to the poor countries, that would give 4% of their GNPs and would only be 18% of what we're now spending on armaments. But equally important would be massive technical assistance programs of far greater magnitude than any previously attempted to produce decision makers, problem solvers, managers, and other technical persons, develop the organizational framework and solutions to specific problems and bottlenecks. Remains to be seen whether the rich and poor nations are up to the task of collectively formulating such a program and operating it effectively. If they cannot do it, the prospects for eliminating poverty are indeed poor. The ultimate consequences could be catastrophic. Well, he's mentioned several times the impact of military expenditures. And who do you suppose are the exporters of arms? Two guesses. United States is one.
USSR.
Yeah, Soviet Union is the other big one. 61 to 75, U.S. government sold military equipment worth $41 billion overseas. Same period, Soviet sold $27 billion. Everybody else together, $9 billion, and that includes France, United Kingdom, and West Germany, Israel. Arms in international trade has increased exponentially. By 1976, total arms exports reached $100 billion. Three quarters of it went to developing countries. For many years, the major exports were confined to weapons that had been replaced by more sophisticated ones of a new generation, but now the supplying nations are offering their clients the best they've got. From the June 1982 background paper from Bread for the World, Military Aid, the World's Poor, and U.S. Security. Military aid proposed by the administration for fiscal year 1983 represents an increase of $3 billion compared with fiscal year 1981, which is nearly the increase in military assistance proposed is almost as big as the entire budget of the U.S. Agency for International Development, $1.77 billion. And the entire U.S. contribution to the international development banks, such as the International Development Association, of $1.26 billion.
Excuse me, Bill, was that our weapon increase or what we were selling to other nations?
Military aid increase. The increase in military aid, not sales, but gifts, for arms, money to be spent in the United States for arms. Is as big as the entire contribution to major forms of direct non-military assistance. So it just says what I believe you said before, that most of our aid is military aid. Trade is an extremely crucial factor in development prospects. The poor countries now export primarily renewable and non-renewable resources rather than manufactured products, well over 80% of their exports. Of those, crude oil is by far the most important, 60% of the total exports, or $130 billion. Originating for the most part in 14 oil-rich developing nations that form OPEC. Now, it cost 10 cents a barrel to extract another barrel of oil in the Middle East from an operating field. So what's a fair price for that oil? The oil companies were charging $1.25 a barrel for it. Thus they declared, in effect, there need be little relationship between price and cost. So why then were we so shocked when OPEC collectively and arbitrarily increased that price by a factor of 4? Well, we were shocked because it hurt, not because it was any different from what is already going on. How does one place a fair value on a resource which is under the ground, which is being extracted, and which will one day be gone, never to reappear?
Bill?
Yes.
I read a little article by Bucky Fuller. He said that he and a friend of his sat down one day and figured out why it cost, you know, what it would cost the earth to produce a gallon of gasoline, and he said that was $2 million worth of solar energy and resources that went into a gallon of gasoline. Mm-hmm. And so that in fact every time you fill up your gas tank you're spending $7 million worth of resources. So that's another way of looking at it.
I think primarily the upper limit on a price is the cost of some substitute that will do the same job acceptably. If we ask the same kind of question about mineral resources, ores for metals and so forth, much of that also can come from developing countries, and they like to try to play the OPEC game with those. But there are some differences. One is that many industrial countries are virtually completely sources themselves of major mineral resources, so the developing countries lose leverage. Except for cobalt, tin, nickel, and bauxite, which is the form of aluminum ore, which is the only one now being used. But nonetheless, developing countries have only a 30% share of non-fuel mineral exports compared to a 70% share of the world export market in fuels. Second difference is that if you raise the price of a particular metal, it usually opens up new reserves of lower grade ores. The more expensive it gets, the larger the resource, because the more becomes available that can be gotten at the market price. Thus, although an embargo on the shipment of copper from Chile, Zambia, Peru, and Zaire to the United States would prove inconvenient, in time the needs could be met by processing local ores. Same for iron, lead, zinc, tungsten, and molybdenum. Third consideration is that metals can be recycled where fuels cannot. In principle, the efficiency could be quite high. And finally, the impact of changing the price of metallic ores would be much less than the impact of changing the price of crude oil. Energy values are much greater than the values of metals. U.S. fuel production is valued at 10 times the value of all the metals processed. And second, very little processing is needed for to get crude oil into gasoline compared to what's needed to take a metallic ore to an ingot of metal. Industrial countries themselves, particularly the United States, Canada, Australia, South Africa, and the Soviet Union, dominate total minerals production. So trade in minerals is now more important for the developing countries than it is for the industrial ones. And one of the real problems they have are the price fluctuations. From 1963 to 66, prices for mineral exports rose about 50%. By 1972, they were well below the 63 level. By 75, they were up 40% again. So the export countries are in no position to plan meaningful programs for development because they have no idea what they will be able to get for export income. And of course, they're often unable to maintain stable governments. The same sort of thing happens with the agricultural exports, of the prices bouncing up and down. At present, the monetary value of agricultural exports is considerably greater than that of non-fuel minerals. In addition, exports of commodities such as coffee and sugar can continue into the indefinite future. There's a limit to the amount of copper or iron that you can expect to extract. But you can keep growing things if you grow them in the right way, but the price stability problem is just as great. Weather, disease, availability of export commodities also goes through cycles of glut and scarcity. The most single important agricultural export of developing countries is what? And important would mean dollar value. No guesses? Come on. Yeah. Agricultural export. Sugar. Made from cane. It could, of course, also be made from sugar beets, but they've closed down a lot of that in eastern Washington because it costs less to get it from the tropics from sugar cane. However, other important agricultural exports, such as coffee, tea, cocoa, and natural rubber, can only be produced in the tropics. So the developing countries do have an important monopoly, realizing that all the tropical countries are in the poor part of the world. Furthermore, they could expand their agricultural exports for soybeans, off-season vegetables, tropical fruits, and cut flowers. And Mexico, of course, has been exporting all of those things to the United States on land that presumably might be used to grow food for Mexicans. On the average, about a third of the cereal grains exported by the rich countries, particularly United States, Canada, and Australia, is purchased by developing countries. making up somewhat over 5% of those countries' total demand. At one time, during days of farm surpluses, the U.S. transferred large quantities of food to needy countries under very favorable terms. But demands from Europe and Japan have grown to such an extent the days of large surpluses appear to be over, he says. I don't know that he'd say that this year. Unless an effective international mechanism for stockpiling is created, the poorest countries will have great difficulty obtaining needed food in emergencies. Exports of manufactured products from the poor countries to the rich ones are increasing. There was a full-page ad in Time magazine, and I have no idea how many tens of thousands of dollars that cost, by the Bank of Brazil. This is another image of the nation that's the world's largest exporter of coffee. More than half, though, last year of Brazil's $23 billion U.S. dollars in exports consisted in industrial products and sophisticated services, compared with 1970, when it was only $2.7 billion. Brazil is one of the 10 most heavily industrialized nations in the West. Agricultural production in 10 years increased 66.7%. So Brazil is close to becoming the second largest food exporter in the world. That would mean edging out Canada, I suppose. In addition, Brazil also exports planes, ships, shoes, canned sweets, textiles, diverse technology, and many other products and services to key markets spanning the globe. Recent years, the average yearly increase in Brazil's gross national product has been one of the highest in the world. And per capita income was nearly $2,000 in 1981. Gross savings, which is a way of forming capital, are equal to 25% of the GNP. Well, the figures for Brazil on income distribution didn't happen to be among those shown here, but any of us who may have seen Excuse Me, America film, or heard what Fritz Norstedt had to say about his experiences in Brazil, will know that that doesn't mean that the lot of all Brazilians has been improving to that extent. I hesitate to say any more because I don't have firsthand information.
The World 2 years ago said that 40% of the people in Brazil were severely malnourished or starving.
Bread for the World in July 79 had an opening paragraph. The Massachusetts shoe worker, or West Virginia shoe worker, has never met her South Korean counterpart, but they're competing for the same job, and the Korean is winning. There have been, of course, some successful efforts on the part of what's left of the U.S. shoe industry to place higher trade barriers, either tariffs or limits on amount that can be accepted as imports from countries like South Korea and Brazil. We're trying to do the same sort of thing with automobiles from Japan, strong-arming Japan into limiting the number of cars they will export to the United States, despite the fact that a lot of people seem to prefer to buy them if they have their choice. And that kind of thing on a global scale is not at all uncommon, but it doesn't really solve the problems of either, because if we don't buy things from developing countries, they can't afford to buy food from us. And ultimately, we as well as they may be the poorer. Now, here are some figures of net flow of resources to developing countries in 1975. There's the Development Assistance Committee, which is 17 market economy industrial nations that make grants or loans either through an international agency or directly from one of those countries to another. The U.S. is still the largest single contributor, but during the decade 65 to 75, its proportional contribution decreased steadily. The total amount of official U.S. development assistance went up from $3.4 billion to $4 billion, but contributions of the others went up fourfold from $2.5 billion to $9.6 billion. The total the official U.S. contributions expressed as a percentage of GNP dropped in that 10 years from 0.49% to 0.27%. The others now contribute at something over 0.4%, and you may recall that Brown suggests that 1% would be about all that could effectively be put to use immediately by the other countries. Okay, so total contributions then from that are about $14 billion in the last year mentioned. Private voluntary agencies, such as foundations and charitable organizations, gave $1.3 billion, almost entirely as grants rather than loans. Then we have to add $22 billion to developing countries in the form of private export credits, direct investment, and loans. But almost all of that went to the middle-income developing countries, less than 6% to the poorest countries. Most of it came through commercial banks, much as relatively short-term loans, and much of that from oil dollars deposited by OPEC countries. Some two-thirds of OPEC's own direct assistance is directed to the non-oil producing members of the Arab League, Egypt being the one receiving the greatest amount. And in addition, they've given substantial commitments to help India and Pakistan pay for the oil they import. It's noteworthy that the total net disbursements by OPEC nations for assistance was 1.58% of their combined GNPs, considerably higher than that of any industrial nation's percentage. The aid expenditures of the communist nations have been very small. Communist economic aid is characterized by concentration on the public sector and tying credits to goods manufactured in the donor countries. By far the largest part of communist aid goes to other communist countries. Since World War II, the impact of the global electronic revolution has been very important. The most remote shepherd boy in the high Andes is likely to have a transistor radio tuned to a rock station. City dwellers watch television and visit motion picture theaters and see whatever picture of our life you get from television and the movies, which may not be completely accurate. The other way they see us are as tourists and visitors. Those on business generally stay in quarters where they can sleep, eat, and partake of luxuries much as they would at home. They encounter numerous waiters, maids, houseboys, porters, drivers, and other service personnel. One cannot help but wonder what a waiter thinks while serving a table where the host spends more in one evening than the waiter receives in 1 month. On the positive side, tens of thousands of students from developing countries enroll in universities in America and Europe. In the United States, close to 100,000 such students working for degrees in engineering, agriculture, medicine, and the natural and social sciences. Information from Science magazine last December. Between 1961 and 1972, the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom gave developing countries $46 billion in assistance, have received back nearly $44 billion in skilled labor, otherwise known as the brain drain. 30% of all physicians in Canada and 22% in the United States are foreign medical graduates who stay in the rich countries rather than going home, even though their early education was at the expense of their home countries. Furthermore, importing skilled workers, although it does allow them to send home $8 billion to their developing homelands, Mexicans working in the United States each support an average of 5.4 dependents by sending back 30% of their earnings, but the greatest profit undoubtedly goes to the host country. Ability to import temporary workers means a country has a reserve supply of labor, and in the mid-1970s, 1.2 million of those temporary workers were sent home from Western Europe because of the economic recession. Multinational corporations, we must say something about them before the time is up. They're increasingly becoming principal agents in the international transfer of capital, manufactured products, information, and technology. Often they are more powerful than nations and frequently unrestrained by governments. Most such corporations were born in the rich countries but now have extensive operations through subsidiaries in developing countries as well. Because they can mobilize and control vast resources, their power to influence national and international affairs is substantial. The involvement of IT&T in U.S. domestic politics, as well as the internal politics of Chile, is a case in point. Right or wrong, multinational corporations have become a major source of tension between rich and poor nations. The solution, if there is one, is by no means obvious. A couple of other perspectives on multinational corporations. Economist Ainsley Cole: the most effective forms of assistance that the developed countries, including the United States, give to the less developed countries are the purchases they make from the less developed countries in international trade. Socialist economist Pierre Jallet wrote in 1968, the less developed countries are not poor because of a curse of nature. They're not lacking in natural wealth, least of all in raw materials for heavy industry. They're poor only because this natural wealth has been and still is being plundered by imperialism for the needs of its own industrialization at the expense of those countries from which it flows away in its raw state. It is quite true, though, that great damage would be done to LDC economies if the developed countries reduced their purchases of commodities. But that doesn't mean that the proceeds go to the poor. There's no reason to believe present-day less developed countries would have developed their natural wealth by now if it were not for the rapacious interference or influence of the developed countries. Chinese did not undergo an industrial revolution, even though they were civilized long before Western Europe, nor did the Arabs, who were also possessed a rich civilization, find or utilize their vast oil resources. Any development that's taking place in OPEC countries now is because of the price that developed countries pay, willingly or unwillingly, for that resource. However, that's somewhat beside the point. In recent years, the resource flow has been predominantly from the less developed to the more developed countries. The rich have been getting steadily richer, and most of the poor have been lucky to stay even. Tom O'Brien: I am not suggesting the underdevelopment of the third world is the result of international efforts by the developed world, but neither is it the result of misguided benevolent intentions leading to unintentionally negative results. The intention of capital is profit, which, even when it includes the benevolent belief that profit for some can be profit for all, nevertheless means that without some political mechanism for redistribution, an ever-widening gap between those who have more capital and those who have less. And that's what has happened, according to all the evidence I've seen, in the last 25 years, 35 years. There has been no conscious conspiracy to depress the third world. The unconscious operation of the market has been enough. So at this point, any few minutes left, I'd like to pose the question, what kind of institutional changes do you see that we could have some influence in trying to bring about, in addition to whatever individual or corporate direct gifts we can make, which are very important, but which cannot by themselves solve the problems? Or what kind of policies should the United States government have, since we should have some influence on the United States government, which is supposed to be us, compared to these other countries, to try to make, from our own selfish perspective, a more secure world, let alone from our other perspectives of wanting a more equitable world. Yes?
Didn't Carter try some things with this human rights requirements that many countries had to abide by before they could get any...
He tried to have the U.S. government have that posture of being selective in aid or having strings attached and not no longer continue to support the most repressive regimes in at least the capitalist side of the world unless they made some steps in the right direction.
Several years ago, again, Bread for the World had a letter writing campaign that we were to request from our representatives and senators that whereas most of our foreign aid, which is less than 1% of our gross national product, went for arms to countries that we wanted to keep friendly with us, like Korea and Pakistan at that time, and a great percentage of our foreign aid was to countries not because they were the most needy, but because we wanted to supply them with military weapons. And I think one thing we can continually do is to just write letters of protest, and I think that has to be changed, that we give foreign aid, not military aid, and not to those that just want, we use food as a weapon, is their point, and give it only to those that are friendly, and military aid is much more than food aid, which you said.
Well, I would gather that food itself is not a solution to the problem, but an immediate response to the greatest individual human needs, but that we must also provide capital and the means to develop the food production in the other countries themselves. Yes?
Bill, who decides how the money gets divided up and to whom?
You mean which countries get the money that the United States government? Congress decides.
They decide proportions?
Dollar amounts to individual countries and in various forms and the various terms.
Well, isn't it usually a proposal put forth by the administration and then the Congress acts on that? Isn't that
right?
The State Department, isn't that where it usually originates?
You're quite right that in recent years, almost all budgetary initiative has come from the president and the executive branch, but Congress may or may not give the president what he wants.
And again, Bread for the World last year was pushing the fact that we give our aid to those countries that can show means of developing, of taking that money and using it for development, mm-hmm. so that it isn't just direct food aid or applying Band-Aids. But it's a way of building wells or storage facilities. And I think that's a very realistic thing that Bread for the World is pushing for.
So what that means, in essence, is that we use our aid to bring about changes that we want to see made in those countries, which would be interpreted at least by those in power there as imposing our will upon them. The difference would be the motivation with which we made those efforts, perhaps.
Wasn't that what the Peace Corps was doing, was sending individuals into individual mm-hmm. countries and to specific spots that had problems, and they used their technology and worked out systems within the people, with the people they were with, so that they use their resources and their people to bring about, you know, better water supply or sewage facility or some kind of solar power or whatever.
Or a lot of it was education, health personnel,
teaching,
and so forth, too.
Yeah.
And, of course, Peace Corps representatives went only to those countries who were willing to accept them under the terms of the program. And to the individuals, I'm sure in many of those cases did make a very considerable impact.
Yeah, they did. They made the paper constantly, even in this country.
What's the present status of the Peace Corps? Anybody know?
It's still going. Vista is dead, but Peace Corps is still going, but they pulled out of quite a few countries that are at least a bit controversial.
Of course, the Peace Corps volunteer had to be very careful about the kinds of statements that that person might make to not become unwelcome.
Yeah. You have to sign something when you either become a Vista or a Peace Corps that you cannot make political statements, you cannot campaign, you can't be a member, or you can't work for a political party.
Yeah, but that's okay, because there are other people that do that.
And government employees do it, not volunteers.
Yeah.
It's when it comes to the benefits of being a government employee, you don't get those, but you get the liabilities. What do you say to... I just graduated with so many people in college that really thought that multinationals were really the answer.
Oh.
To so many, I mean, and that's the kind of jobs that they were applying for, and even in the ALC, when we're talking about South Africa, so many people still believe the trickle-down theory, and that our multinationals are there primarily to do good for that country rather than for profit purposes, and that...
Well, what other model do we have, assuming that creation of more wealth is necessary, although woefully insufficient for improving the lot of the desperately poor majority? What other mechanism has been shown to be successful even in creating the wealth?
Can't hear you. What?
Mainland China, it would be one maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But we argue that it hasn't been that successful, but we've made some pretty big strides.
Certainly as far as hunger is concerned. But is that a model we want to promote?
Tanzania is making a lot of efforts of development within their own country without... They haven't allowed the multinationals to come in, and they don't accept United States foreign aid. And that, things are changing really slowly, but things are changing.
And yet a model of our completely having no involvement with another country doesn't seem like
it. Well, the reason that Tanzania hasn't accepted any offers of aid in the United States or the Soviet Union is because of the strings attached.
Mm-hmm.
And
they will accept private aid.
Yeah, they've accepted. There's a program called Operation Bootstrap that they and now they accept money for education. I think they might accept money from some non-aligned countries.
They accept from United Nations organization? Mm-hmm.
Another subject that really worries me is the multinationals that go into the country simply to strip it, or they build their factory there because we won't allow them to build it here because it's so dirty. And I know that the environmentalists in Japan are really having a tough time with their industries, the ones that have the mercury pollution and some of the other bad ones that they've driven out of Japan, have just gone into other third world, fourth world countries, set up business there and just pollute away like crazy in those countries and use their resources there. And that's one of the things that really bothers me about our multinationals, because we've tried to get them here in the last 10 years to clean up their act a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, they sure fought every step of the way, fighting tooth and claw on that. And unless we can get them all to do it at the same time, then they will say, oh yeah, we should do that for the country. If everybody has to do it, then they're willing. But if one is an exception, they aren't. And we chase them right out of this country into those countries to dirty them up. And I just, that's the wrong thing for us to be doing. And I don't know how to get them to stop.
One of the last things that President Carter signed was legislation to, or executive order, I'm sorry, to forbid export of commodities which are banned for sale in the United States without telling the other countries that they had been banned in the United States. One of the first things Reagan did was to rescind that. And there are some rather thoroughly documented horror stories, particularly with the population control means that are not approved in the United States, have been banned in the United States, and which the Agency for International Development of the United States is very aggressively promoting in third world countries. Mary?
What was in the United Nations in the 70s the push for the new economic order?
Okay.
What was involved in that? What were their answers to distribution and development?
First, let's see, the International Conference on International Economic Cooperation in the spring of 1977, 16 industrial and 19 developing nations. Industrial nations offered a $1 billion special fund to help the poorest nations meet their bill for oil, other imports, and interest, agreement to set up a common fund that would stabilize commodity prices, pledged to step up assistance for development of agriculture and increase the financial resources of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. In return, the industrial nations requested guaranteed access to oil and other raw materials, protection against arbitrary nationalization of foreign investments, as well as a continuing forum for discussion of global energy problems. Developing nations did not agree. Emphasized the major components of the new international economic order. Let's see, I thought it was right here. Debt relief, refused to offer safeguards against nationalization. More recently, 1979, the meeting in Manila, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. The new subclassifications have become necessary. Advanced developing countries and least developed countries, rather than last. Socialist LDCs and neo-capitalist LDCs, non-oil LDCs and OPEC LDCs. Calls for a new economic order were often ignored by the advanced developing countries. Oh, it is here what they had asked for. Agreements involving trade position. Establish a mechanism to eliminate these large and disastrous price fluctuations. Major relaxation of restriction against importing manufactured products from them by us. Second, a system of economic and technical assistance more binding on the donor nations than the present voluntary system. Official development assistance increased considerably above present levels, and relief from the indebtedness serving interest payments that takes away half of their new assistance each year, goes right back as interest payments. Lastly, International Monetary Fund to create a new and truly international currency which it would regulate to facilitate growth of production and exports in developing countries. To accomplish this, they'd like a near equal vote with the rich countries in the International Monetary Fund. However, since then, the various categories within those groups and are not unanimous. Calls for a new economic order are often ignored by the advanced developing countries. The Costa Rican delegation mustered some support from other oil-deficient Latin American countries for its proposal that OPEC consult with the importing LDCs before it raises prices again, but African and Asian delegations squelched the resolution partly out of fear that OPEC might reduce its aid to any country daring to challenge them. A resolution calling for the industrialized nations to cancel or suspend debts of the less developed countries was quietly suppressed by some of the capitalistic advanced developing countries, although the U.S. had already written off $500 million in debts owed by 15 of the poorest nations. ADCs like South Korea, Singapore, and Brazil have feared that any further write-off would make them appear to be poor credit risks and that international lenders might push up interest rates or hold back on future loans. Second thoughts about the World Commodity Fund to stabilize prices. Delegates of many commodity-producing LDCs argued such a resolution would help the developed countries more than the undeveloped, because 60% of all commodities and raw materials originate in five developed countries, the U.S., Canada, the Soviet Union, Australia, and South Africa. Together, 60% of all commodities and raw materials in international trade. The poorest nations, including Chad and Afghanistan, called for more help from the richest countries, but delegates for those industrial nations felt the advanced developing countries must also be willing to help, should lower their own tariffs against the least developed nations and give up some of the special tariff preferences they receive from industrial countries. The overall mood of the conference was disappointment. Fortunately, most nations backed a resolution calling for substantially increased aid to the 30 poorest countries. Two-thirds of those 30 poorest countries are in Africa. Others include Haiti, Bangladesh, Laos, and Yemen. Sometimes described as fourth world or basket cases, they constitute still a further division among the developing nations and a growing problem the rest of the world will have to address.